We're learning about the work of ski patrolling on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So I think of ski patrol as pertaining to their obvious duty, that is caring for an injured skier on the slopes. But there's a lot more to it. Worldwide, the National Ski Patrol consists of more than 31,000 people serving 650 patrols, some paid, some volunteer. We'll get into that. Are you a member of a ski patrol? How long have you been part of the patrol? What are your memories of helping others ski safely? 800-642-1234. Mark Anderson is communication advisor for the South Central Region of the National Ski Patrol. They train and support volunteer ski patrollers through 13 different patrols over multiple ski areas in South and Eastern Wisconsin. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So surely I don't mean to call out your age, but you've been skiing for better than a half a century. And then Ski Patrol came along for you in 2016, I think it was. How did you get into it?
Well, I had been thinking about Ski Patrol for decades. I remember probably 1969 watching a young patroller being evaluated on the hill. And I thought, I'm not sure I could ever do that. So when I retired, my wife wanted to get me out from underfoot, and so she encouraged me to check it out. And today we're both ski patrollers. So
I was going to say, I think both of you are.
That's correct. Yes.
Well, yep. So much for staying out of her business and you staying out of yours.
Do you exactly.
Crisscross each other on the slopes?
We do. We patrol. We have a shared shift on Tuesdays, so we do a lot of skiing together.
Can you describe a day in the life of a ski patrol member? What is it like?
Well, it depends a little bit on the hill that you are at. There's similarities across all patrols, and then each hill has some unique features. It starts before your shift begins. You sign in these days of COVID, you check your temperature and go through the checkoff sheet for COVID. We want to be safe at all times. You open the lifts in most cases, if not all. So you ride up the lift, making sure the lift is operating safely. You ski the runs to make sure there's no dangerous spots on the runs. And then you check the equipment, toboggans perhaps that are out on the hill, make sure they're all clean and easily accessible and ready to go. And then you patrol for the rest of the day, looking for opportunities to help people, dangerous situations, people who might need a little help, or even direction to where the bunny slope is. So you respond to an incident and take it from there and rely on your training.
That training so important. I would imagine it even goes beyond CPR. What kind of training is involved?
Well, it's a very thorough process. Both my wife and I aren't from any kind of a medical field in our professional lives. So the steps to becoming a patroller are basically selecting the patrol that you would be interested in and contacting that patrol. They will roster you on their patrol and you'll join the NSP organization. And then you'll go through medical training, which is titled Outdoor Emergency Care, which is a 3 to 6 month, depending on the patrol that's running the class, 3 to 6 month process. There's a written test for the knowledge content there. And there's a practical evaluation where you demonstrate proficiency with the skills and dealing with different scenarios. Mm. At that point, having passed those, you are a ski patroller, basic level. And then you move on to the on-hill training, which refines your skiing skills and techniques, all with an eye towards being able to very capably transport a patient in a toboggan to get them either to the aid room or a higher level of care. And that is an evaluation of both your skiing skills and your toboggan handling skills in both the handles of the toboggan and on the tail rope. And having done those things, the medical training in the summer and fall and the on-hill training when there's snow out there, you are now a alpine ski patroller.
It's a commitment, yes. Mark,
it is, yes.
Mark Anderson with us, communication advisor for the South Central region of the National Ski Patrol, getting us acquainted with the work of what a ski patrol does and what is involved in becoming one. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. What has been the impact of COVID? Because we've seen numbers that there are a lot of skiers out there topping some records. What have you seen at ski resorts here in Wisconsin?
The same thing last year, the 2021 ski season, we saw a lot of those record numbers of people getting out. And to some degree, there was a challenge for the hills to deal with the influx. It was a chance for people to get outside and do something pretty naturally socially distanced. And it made for a very busy year.
Well, when you have a lot of skiers out there on a weekend or during a holiday, how does that affect your work as a ski patroller?
It's really just volume. You're still doing exactly the same things. It's just you're probably going to be dealing with more interactions with the customers. And sadly, with more people may come more injuries. We hate to see that, but it's an active outdoor sport and things can happen.
We're going to look a little bit more at safety in skiing, but I want to ask you, this is a lot of work for a volunteer, and there has been difficulty, a shortage of getting ski patrollers to do this. What, you know, how do you look at that shortage or at this volunteerism?
Well, there's a lot of rewards that come with being a ski patroller. We can chat on those in a moment if you want. The 2020 season did see a reduction in patrollers in a number of spots. The National Ski Patrol offered patrollers an opportunity to remain a member of the Ski Patrol, but opt out of patrolling last year for, you know, health concern reasons. In my experience, I'm not aware of any hill being understaffed, but it was a leaner set of crews that would be available or people on the crew. The shifts were all manned or womaned, you know, the situation was safe, but there was just a little bit more activity going on.
It also, as you described the training involved, it made me wonder who pays for all the first aid training and the CPR recertifications and, you know, not to mention equipment you need to be a ski patrol.
Well, excellent point. At the beginning of your introduction to becoming a ski patroller, you'll probably hear the words that if you were thinking this would be a good way to get in some free skiing, you'd be better served by getting a season pass, and it'll be a lot easier. The vast majority of patrollers in Wisconsin are volunteer patrollers, and there are some costs that come along with that. Obviously, you have to have your own ski gear. You purchase your ski, your patrol parka and your backpack, and in a number of hills, you do the initial supply load into your pack. There's fees that go along with the various training courses that you do, and other recertification things, clinics you might attend. So it's the volunteer patroller who pays those fees.
Ski Patrol volunteer with the South Central region of Wisconsin, Mark Anderson, with us explaining what it takes to do this as part of the National Ski Patrol. Has a ski patroller ever come to your aid? What happened? Have you befriended a ski patroller in your years of skiing at a particular resort? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Mark Anderson here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a day in the life of a volunteer ski patroller on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. They help keep people safe on the mountain or the slopes here in Wisconsin. The National Ski Patrol was founded over 80 years ago, follows the motto of service and safety. They make skiing more enjoyable and safe, give first aid. Have you thought about volunteering? What would you like to know? How long have you been a downhill skier? What do you love about it? 800-642-1234. Mark Anderson of the South Central region with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's go to Pete now from Mount Morris. Hi, Pete. What is your question?
I was wondering, is there an upper limit for age as far as being into the ski patrol, getting into the ski patrol? And number two, the time commitment, like how many nights a week, how many weekend days are required or expected?
Great questions, Pete. Thank you. Mark?
So on the first one, upper age limit, I'm not aware of any. I ski with patrollers who are into their 80s, and they ski smooth like butter.
Oh, awesome.
One of the most physical things is probably an extrication and the transport in the toboggan, and we refresh and recertify in our capabilities on that. And if someone gets to the point that that's not something they feel safe and comfortable doing, then they might not participate in that particular activity. But we always need patrollers in the aid room when we come in with an injured customer. From 18 to 80s is the age range. And there's also a young patroller's classification as well under 18.
What about the time commitment?
Well, the biggest time commitment is going to be your first year when you are a candidate. You'll go through that outdoor emergency care class. That's probably an evening a week. Different patrols have a different format. You'll also be doing your on-hill training as a candidate. So in addition to your normal shift, you'll have another point in the week, evening perhaps, or Sunday morning or something like that, that you are skiing. Once you're a full-fledged patroller, you'll work your normal shift. In my wife's and my situation, that's Tuesdays. So we start at 8 in the morning and we're normally leaving about 5:30 or 6 in the evening. Mm-hmm. Other patrols are more flexible. You sign up for particular, Tuesday afternoon there, Saturday morning there, and you fill out your schedule as opposed to having a fixed routine. So it's probably one day a week.
Okay.
Plus any other training and clinics you're attending.
Well, let's go to Sarah now in Green Bay. Hi, Sarah. What's your story with Ski Patrol?
Hi. Good morning. I just had kind of a fun story. When I was in middle school, I was an avid skier and I was trying out snowboarding for the very first time at Nordic Mountain in Mount Morris, and crashed big, ended up breaking my wrist. And the person that came to my aid was actually my middle school gym teacher, who was my gym teacher at the time, but also a ski patrolman on his in his free time. And so it was kind of just a funny thing to have my gym teacher come and save me. And it was cool to see him in a different light. And I'm grateful that I knew him and that he could calm me down when I was panicky.
Oh, what a great story, Sarah. Thank you so much. Mark, I bet this is what you really love to hear, these types of stories.
They are. That's a big part of, I think, why every patroller gets into it, is the opportunity to help people in their moment of need.
You received your first pair of skis in December of 1968, and you remember it well. What do you remember about your first ski trip?
Well, they were used skis. They came from the Army surplus store on the square in Madison. And we were ready to go skiing at Cascade on the 26th, but we got 18 inches of snow. And so instead of skiing, I shoveled the driveway all day. And the next day, my mom gave me a ride up to Cascade Mountain with a school friend who had kind of drawn me into it. And he started teaching me how to snow plow with those old cable binding leather boot setup.
And fast forward to the early 70s, you met your wife skiing.
I did. That's probably the best skiing thing. Skiing has been a big part of our life together.
I see a theme here.
It is. Yeah, we met in Wittenberg, Wisconsin, at Gus Nan's restaurant on a college ski trip to the Porcupine Mountains.
Oh.
And we got engaged there, too. And today I'm teaching my grandkids to ski. We've gotten them all started at about 3 years old, and it's a real joy to follow them down the hill and watch them do their stuff.
What would you recommend for those little tots as you put them on the hill for the first time? Give us some tips.
Well, I would highly recommend a lesson. Sometimes a child will listen a little bit better to someone else than they will to their parent.
Funny how that happens. Carry on. Yeah.
There are also, having gone through that, there's a harness, a training harness for little kids that you can get where, you know, a capable skiing adult can control the speed with a couple of straps from behind the skier, but they're still, controlling their skis and their body and so on and so forth, so they can get the feel of everything without any risk of getting out of control. And start on an appropriately easy hill.
My little ones are nervous about chairlifts. They don't like the idea. How can you get them accustomed to chairlifts?
That is a good question. I would have to think about that. One thing that I would recommend, most chairs are equipped with a retention bar.
Mm-hmm.
It flips down over your head. Those are there for a reason. Slide them down, and that'll help keep the parent be more comfortable about the little squirm worm that's sitting next to them on the patrol. The lift operators, if you talk to them, they will slow the lift down for you and help the younger ones, the shorter ones, get onto the chair.
Oh, they will. So you just have to speak up a little bit.
That's right. That's right. They want to help as well. The chair is a very safe thing. They are inspected regularly. I guess it would be a little bit unique to the child.
Mm-hmm.
A calming voice from the parent.
In terms of adults, you know, skiing carries that inherent risk of injury. What are your tips for staying safe while we adults ski?
Well, a couple things there. One, there is in Wisconsin law, there is a code of responsibility and conduct for a skier, knowing your skiing ability, being aware of the runs that you're going to be on when you get off whatever lift you're on, wear a helmet, those kinds of things.
Do you find that people don't wear helmets as often as they should? I mean, in my generation, kids didn't wear helmets.
You know, just the opposite. The majority, I'm going to say 70, 80, 90% of the skiers that I see are wearing helmets.
Okay.
They're warm. They're safe. My wife for 17 years ran the middle school ski bus. And when they began to require helmets of all the middle school kids on those outings, the trips to the aid room decreased markedly.
Wow.
So you can rent them. They'll come in the rental package. So if you don't own yours, you can rent one, but I highly recommend. And we try to lead by example, and patrollers, you're almost always going to see a patroller wearing a helmet as well.
Well, Mark, enjoy the visit. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Mark Anderson is communication advisor for the South Central region of the National Ski Patrol. He's been skiing 53 years, signed up to be part of Ski Patrol in 2016. Ahead this hour, we talk about the SAT testing and changes. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a woman setting the record straight on history.
Joyce Alter Johnson has loved history her entire life. But as a descendant of slaves, her family history, like the history of many Black families across the country, was largely struck from the historical record. Johnson had to take it upon herself to uncover her family's roots. WPR's Christine Hatfield brings you her story.
Who we are is determined by where we come from, our parents, where they come from, their parents, where their parents come from, and a chain of unbreakable links that could explain not only our genetic makeup, but also our personalities.
Joyce Salter Johnson's love of history started with a missing link in her family's history. She says her grandmother appeared to have no roots at all. She essentially lived alone in a nice house in the South that her grandfather sent money home to build while he worked on the Illinois Central Railroad. Johnson has always been a storyteller, and the holes in her family's history left room for her curiosity to thrive. When she reached adulthood, that curiosity transformed from fantasy into research. It took years to get answers to her family's story.
Before 1866, there was nothing written in any archive about slaves. Nothing. The information that you needed to find out about the enslaved person was in the archives or the databases or the journals of the people that held them enslaved.
Eventually, she traced the Salters back to 1792, when Hardy Salter was born to enslaved parents in Virginia. The journey of the Salters took them to Good Hope, Mississippi. That's where Joyce Salter Johnson grew up. Over the years, life led Johnson to Freeport, Illinois, and eventually Madison, where she's lived for more than 30 years. But it was Freeport's Historical Society that inspired Joyce's next historical endeavor.
So for years, we would always get these really nice publications about Freeport. And often it was a historic publication about Freeport. And there was never, ever one picture of any African American in those publications.
When she asked why, she was told there weren't records of African Americans living there, let alone pictures. So she began combing through the historical records herself, finding stories of centuries worth of Black settlers in the county.
In order for history to be accurate, it must present an inclusive record of all people. Unfortunately, in the past, a substantial portion of the history of the Negro in Stevenson County has been omitted. This omission has allowed generations of the county's residents, both Black and white, to grow up with a distorted view of Stevenson County and the roles African American have played in its development. And that's what I had to give to them, and they said, of course we'll publish your book. I place people of African descent in that time and place, in that space, where they should have been automatically put in that space.
Johnson says she's glad to see her books as more than just family history. She says they're textbooks people can learn from. As for herself, life has carried on through the years of research and hard work. She found her way into early childhood education and led Madison's Early Childhood Learning Center, taking in children who needed extra care. At 82, her work isn't done just yet. She still has another book to write and more history to share with the world.
Joy Salter Johnson is the author of numerous historical books. WPR's Christine Hatfield brought you her story. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to college admissions. Your thoughts on the news out of the College Board this week that the SAT will be shortened from 3 hours to 2. It'll go all digital. Do you remember sitting for the SAT or another standardized test? What was it like? Do you get anxiety when taking standardized exams? Do you think that they should be a factor in college admissions? 800-642-1234. Nick Anderson covers higher ed for The Washington Post. Nick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. Give us a sketch here as to what is changing about the SAT.
Sure. Well, it's basically a format issue. The format had been for basically forever, pencil and paper and
bubbles.
Bubbles, but filling out bubbles on the answer sheet and having sharpened number two pencils, not mechanical pencils, but number two pencils, and having good erasers and sort of having a mindset that that you're good not only at answering the test, but filling out the bubbles on the answer sheet for an extended period of time. There's a certain kind of focus that is required to do that, and that's been part of the SAT and ACT experience. ACT is the rival college admission test. Don't forget about that. There's another test out there. So now that the SAT has said it's going digital, here's what that means. It will be provided, the test will be provided on a laptop or a computer, not at home, but in a proctored environment, typically at a local school. You might have your own laptop, which would be outfitted with special software, or you might use a school-provided device, or if you don't have either of those, the College Board says it would lend you a laptop or a device to take the test. The test would roll out on computer first internationally in spring of 2023, and then domestically in the United States in spring of 2024. So that's the schedule for it. A couple of notes about the change in format. It will be shorter. It will be significantly shorter. It has been 3 hours, at least 3 hours for a long time, sometimes longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
But now it will be about 2 hours. And it will have adaptive questions, which is going to be a very interesting thing. What that means is the first section of questions that you answer will be determinative of the second kind of questions that you answer on, say, the math part of the test or the reading and writing part of the test.
So it will adjust or adapt to how you're doing.
Yeah, that's a big deal. I think people will be very interested in how that works and what that means for your score ultimately. So those are a few of the highlights.
What about calculators?
Yeah, calculators have long been allowed on the test, except there have been parts of the SAT that are no calculator. And so the idea behind the no calculator section was, show us your stuff without any mechanical help. Now, the new SAT revision, once it takes effect, will allow the calculator throughout the math portion of the test. There won't be any distinction between calculator or no calculator. You can use it the whole time.
Will it be difficult or cumbersome to take the test online? Because I've also heard reports from the College Board that there will be less fatigue factor in this test.
Yeah, I think that remains to be seen. Obviously, if the test is shorter, that's less cumbersome.
Mm-hmm.
There are potential glitch issues here where computers can malfunction in ways that pencil and paper don't. And so, you know, I think they'll have to be have an eye on that. The College Board says that it's making the program durable to last through those kinds of glitches so that your test would not be spoiled if there is some kind of outage in connectivity or if your computer turns off accidentally. But that's, I think, something to keep an eye on is will the test have technical bumps? And, you know, another more broader thing to keep an eye on is, you know, is the test in going digital, is it going to be, is that format going to be equitable? Will different kinds of students have similar and equitable experiences in taking the test that way? TBD.
I'm wondering the why, because, you know, I think that the College Board was feeling pressure to make the SAT more accessible, less of a giant pressure headache on students who are going through this. And as we have seen, colleges navigating away from the SAT and the ACT, do you think that forced this change?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. There's two answers that come to mind immediately about why. Number one is kind of the world is going digital, and isn't there a certain inevitability about that? You know, I do my work digitally. You probably do a lot of your work digitally, right? So, and students are getting more digital in their class assignments. You know, a lot of schoolwork is done digitally now that didn't used to be done digitally in the past. So there is that. But there is a very important backdrop to all of this, and that is that the testing system is under great challenge. The pandemic led universities and colleges across the country to halt or suspend their test score requirements for admission. Certainly the University of Wisconsin is one of those in your state, and that has actually been extended through early 2025. I spoke with the admissions director at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's very interested to see how this test optional period works for the state flagship there. And, you know, so as schools are suspending their testing requirements, they're waking up to the question of, well, are these tests necessary at all? And that is, you know, a big issue. There have always been critics of the SAT who say, you know, it doesn't really serve much purpose. It's not as predictive of college performance as you suspected, as people claim it would be. It is really a hurdle, not help in getting a read on whether students are college ready. And so there is that argument. People who hold that view say that grades and transcripts are much more important, how tough the classes are that you took in high school.
But I've always heard the pushback, too, that these tests level the playing field, especially for students of color, because there's much more emphasis on grades when you don't have the standardized exams in play, and grading comes with bias.
Yeah, and right now we're seeing essentially a major experiment nationwide with colleges being test optional about that could help settle this argument. So we'll see, you know, how students do, whether they submitted test scores or not, and whether that was predictive in some different way for the different groups when they went into their first year of college. This experiment is live right now. But yes, the idea of the test is to uncover talent. The idea of the test is to confirm that your grades really were good. The idea of the test is to spot academic potential and to level the playing field. But there are many questions about whether the ideals of that are true in reality.
And I've been so curious to ask you this. I'm wondering if you think that the trend of test optional that we're seeing at so many institutions, was that going to be coming anyway, or was that hastened by the pandemic? Or if the pandemic didn't happen, would colleges still be wedded to the ACT and SAT for entrance?
Yeah, I think the pandemic was a game changer. There certainly was a test optional movement that was slowly and steadily gaining strength around the country. I could point to many prominent colleges that have been thinking about test optional before the pandemic. In fact, and some did go test optional, like the University of Chicago. It went test optional in 2018. Well, that was before the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very exclusive school. So there are examples of test optionality that predate the pandemic, but no, the pandemic really flipped the switch and said to colleges, okay, not only is it acceptable to be test optional, but it's pretty much mandatory to be test optional for these first couple of years because the testing system was so inaccessible to so many students.
Nick Anderson covers higher ed for The Washington Post as we get an update on changes to college admissions in these times. Your thoughts on the SAT and the admissions process that you see, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about college admissions with veteran education journalist for The Washington Post. Nick Anderson is here. What about the fraught question about whether race should be a factor in college admissions? Still time, 800-642-1234. Nick Anderson with us for a few more minutes. I want to look at the U.S. Supreme Court recently announcing it would review lawsuits against Harvard and UNC Chapel Hill over how those schools consider race in accepting students. What are these cases about?
Yeah, these are really interesting cases because they challenge the idea that has been accepted Supreme Court precedent for decades, that it's okay within certain limits to consider race in reviewing an application to college or university. The Supreme Court has said since 1978, at least, that yes, you may consider race. You can't have specific numerical quotas set aside for certain races or ethnicities. That's unconstitutional, according to the Supreme Court, but it is allowed to consider it within certain guidelines. And so now, with a new Supreme Court majority, comes another challenge to this idea. And we'll see what happens. The court is going to hear arguments in this, we believe, in the fall term, and it could shake up college admissions in a significant way.
In what way? What impact do you see happening on higher ed if these policies are overturned?
Well, many college admission leaders, public and private, believe that it is important to consider race as one factor among many. In order to achieve a diverse class, a diverse student body on campus. When you think about it, colleges have an interest in not only in teaching students specific curriculum areas, but in teaching students about the world. And part of the world is, you know, if your classmates may look different than you do, if they have different backgrounds than you do. And so when they assemble a class, they're looking not only at how well you did in school, but also that diversity element that may sort of question your own background a little bit and give you cause to sort of see the world in a different way. Mm. That's the idea behind having diverse campuses. And to have diverse campuses takes work. There are mm-hmm. different ways to achieve diversity. But one of the most direct ways to achieve diversity, and a lot of people say the most efficient way, is to consider it as one factor among many.
And we are out of time. Nick, thank you for joining us.
Okay.
Nick Anderson covers higher ed for The Washington Post. More than 10,000 people in Wisconsin have died from COVID, and this month's spike in infections saw more Wisconsinites hospitalized with the disease than at any time since the pandemic started. And this week, WPR is sharing stories of how the pandemic has been felt by Wisconsinites in their own words.
My name's Jackie Cutts, and I currently live in La Crosse, Wisconsin. I worked frontline from a public health standpoint on pandemic response for 2020 and all through 2021. You work all the time and you think about it when you're not working, and it was kind of this all-encompassing thing where you just want to help people and save lives and try to guide the community through this really intense, awful experience, but then find that the very people you're trying to help, some of them are the people who don't just not want help, but they hate you for it. I still have no regrets, and I'm fiercely proud of the work that I did with my team in 2021, but there's only so many times you can, you know, be swore at and yelled at and called names and receive death threats. You know, there's only so much of that before it kind of starts to wane on you, even if you know that what you're doing is the right thing.
My name is Kyle from DeForest, Wisconsin. I live with my wife and my 2-year-old daughter. When the pandemic began, we did only want to see people outside. So we were outside on our patio. My wife and I had chairs on one side with our daughter, and my mother and my stepfather were on the other side. And that, I'm sure, was very heartbreaking that she couldn't hold her granddaughter. She didn't want to wear a mask. My mother and my sisters like to live their lives as if COVID-19 isn't really happening. So every time that we visited since then, it was the same thing. We have to be outside. And that was fine until the winter months hit. At that point, the vaccines were just coming out. And I was so excited. But then after talking to my sister, my mom decided, no, we're too hurt. We haven't seen our granddaughter or niece in 6 months. We don't think you're ready. And I couldn't believe it. I knew I was causing pain, but I just didn't know how hurt they were.
My name is Marita Stolenwerk. I have 3 children, a 5th grader and 2 4th graders, and I currently live in Brookfield, Wisconsin. During the pandemic, I was a consultant for a national firm, and when I heard that we were going to lock down, I went to go talk to my manager and I cried. I said, I don't know how I'm going to do this and have the kids at home. I remember I was rehearsing to give a presentation with my colleagues, and my daughter sat behind me and screamed because she needed my help before she could submit an assignment, and I couldn't help her because I was busy. So in December of 2020, I decided that I would apply for another opportunity. And I felt very conflicted about leaving the position that I was in. I had worked really hard to be at that position, but I felt like I was failing in so many ways. It was a little bit of a pay cut, but it is more manageable in terms of me being able to be engaged with my family.
Some people interviewed for the story shared their experiences with WPR's Wisconsin. You can read and hear more stories about the pandemic's effect on Wisconsinites at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.